Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Humphrey Bogart died over 50 years ago, but his image lives on. As my guest Stephen Kanfer writes, no one claims to have discovered the new Humphrey Bogart with good reason. There was nothing like him before his entrance. There's been nothing like him since his exit. Stephen Kanfer's new book is titled Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. He joins me in the studio. First, let's listen to a clip from one of Humphrey Bogart's best-known films. Here he is with Ingrid Bergman, Claude Rains, in the 1942 film Casablanca.
If you don't mind, you fill in the names. That'll make it even more official.
You think of everything, don't you?
And the names are Mr. and Mrs. Victor Laszlo.
But why my name, Richard?
Because you're getting on that plane.
I don't understand. What about you?
I'm staying here with him until the plane gets safely away.
No, Richard, no. What has happened to you last night?
We said a great many things. You said I was to do the thinking for both of us. Well, I've done a lot of it since then. It all adds up to one thing. You're getting on that plane with Victor where you belong.
But, Richard, no, I...
Now, you've got to listen to me. You have any idea what you'd have to look forward to if you stayed here? 9 chances out of 10, we'd both wind up in a concentration camp. Isn't that true, Louis?
I'm afraid, Major Strauss, I would insist.
You're saying this only to make me go.
I'm saying it because it's true. Inside of us, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
But what about us?
We'll always have Paris. We didn't have, we lost it until you came to Casablanca. We got it back last night.
When I said I would never leave you.
And you never will. But I've got a job to do, too. Where I'm going, you can't follow. What I've got to do, you can't be any part of. Ilse, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that. Now, now. He's looking at you, kid.
How I love those last words, Stephen.
They are irresistible, aren't they?
Truly, truly, but you know, I was sitting here listening in my headphone and concentrating on the sound of his voice. Mm-hmm. That voice is so unusual. Where
did it come
from?
It is. It's very musical. Well, you know, he had a long, long apprenticeship in the theater. And also radio was very important in those days. We're talking the 20s and the 30s.
Of course.
And so he learned to project, and I think he has a great music in his voice. I listen all the time to him, and just now when you hear him, it doesn't amount to a hill of beans. And as he stresses beans, he makes those things seem more important because of the way he articulates them. He always was, I think, an expert at kind of making his voice into a musical instrument.
You have titled this book The Extraordinary, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. Why did you want to include the afterlife?
Because, as you point out, he's been gone for more than 50 years, and yet he's with us. Why is that so? Largely because I think there's no male equivalent. We have in films today what are called boy men, you know, not to single out too many people, but Leonardo DiCaprio, that sort of individual, Tobey Maguire. They don't have the faces or the voices that men did in the 40s and 50s in film, and Bogart seemed to be the quintessence of that.
Sort of craggy, not terribly good-looking, but somehow you had faith in their masculinity.
That's true. It was called a lived-in face, I think. Partly, I think, alcohol and partly tobacco, but also experience.
Interesting that he came from such a well-to-do family.
That's right. The name Humphrey Bogart would not ordinarily have been accepted in a filmdom that used Kirk Douglas, for example, rather than Issar Danielovich. But I think he had had so much experience in the theater, they accepted him as that. His father was a doctor, pretty well-known surgeon, and his mother was famous. She was perhaps the most famous illustrator of her time, Maud Humphrey. Her stuff is all over the place. Even now, it's collector's items. The Gerber Baby, for example, is what she did. He wasn't the Gerber Baby, but she did the Gerber Baby on all those...
Maybe tiny little jars,
right.
Yeah.
So she was famous long before he was.
It's interesting that when she died, however, he listed her as housewife.
Yes, I think he and his mother never got along very well. She was not an emotional woman. No one ever called her mother. He had two sisters, and they referred to her as Maud. That was the way it was. And she displayed so little affection that I think it's one of the reasons why he had trouble with women. You know, Lauren Bacall was his fourth wife, and he married three other actresses. I think he had a lot of trouble relating to women.
I had the privilege of speaking with Lauren Bacall years ago. Still a gorgeous, beautiful, wonderful woman. I gather she has had a hip fracture in recent months, which was too bad. But beyond the comparison between the likes of the young, good-looking men that one sees coming out of Hollywood these days, what is it about Humphrey Bogart's afterlife? What is it about the African Queen or Casablanca that continues to draw us in?
First of all, I think he is the essence of cool. That is, he's a little removed from his role. He believes in his role, he acts his role, but at the same time, he looks at the world through that role with a sort of a disinterested eye. He's not going to trust anyone. And I think in this world that we live in today, that's an admirable way to go through life, just taking a look and not buying everything because somebody tells you it. And the other part of it is that he divided this world from the first time he acted into professionals and bums. And he occasionally acted like a bum and was very sorry about it. Most of the time, he was a professional. And you can see it in those roles. Whatever plays on the screen is what he is. If he's a detective, he is the detective. If he's a kind of a hard scrabble, a boatman, as he was in African Queen, you buy him as that. He's in that role.
I want to ensure that our listeners know you can see some clips from Humphrey Bogart's films on our website. Go to drshow.org, and they're all there for you to enjoy right now. However, Stephen Kampfer is with me. He's the author of a brand new book titled Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. So join us on 800-433-8850. His father, you said, was a doctor. He wanted Humphrey Bogart to become a doctor.
He did. And, of course, Humphrey was a rebel all his life. That was the last thing he wanted to be. But he didn't know exactly what he did want to be. So he, first of all, got kicked out of prep schools, which is sort of the normal thing for rebels of
his. He went to Andover.
Oh, yes. Very fine school. Yeah. Father got him. His father was a Yale graduate, wanted him to be a Yalee as well. He did everything he could to fail everything he could, and then joined the Navy. And it was in the Navy that people feel, there are many stories about it, but he told his friend Nat Benchley the real story, which was that he was guarding a prisoner, and the prisoner whacked him with the handcuffed hands and put a permanent scar in his upper lip, resulting in that kind of diction that he had, tight diction. Oh, yes, later you'll give me millions. That kind of diction, which was unique, as you point out. That voice is unmistakable on radio and film clips. You just know it's Bogart.
So, but didn't he also have some trouble in the Navy?
He did. Once again, we're dealing with father figures. And once again, he has trouble with father figures. Well, in the Navy, you don't have trouble with father figures because they knock you down and put you in the stockade.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what happened. He got knocked down and put in the stockade. So that kind of rebellion later took place when he gave directors, film directors, who were daddy, of course, some problems, but he never gave them that big a problem.
But I want to interject, he was discharged honorably,
was he not? He was, and he saw very little action. He was in at the very end of the war, but at the same time, he did wear the uniform, and he had to obey. It's probably the first time he did have to obey, and he learned how to do that.
How did the acting interest begin? Was it simply because he didn't know what else to do?
Yes, more or less. He had a friend named Bill Brady, whose father was a producer. And so they began to throw this kid into roles. You know, there were big casts in those days. And you needed to change the scene every now and then. So someone would come in and say, in effect, tennis, anyone? And everyone would leave the stage and go to play tennis so they could change the scenery. And he was the juvenile. Believe it or not, he was a pretty young man. And
I've seen photographs of him as a young man.
And you can see that he changed over the course of years, as I say, partly because he had to change, partly because he had a hard-worn life of alcohol and tobacco. He later played a role that was central in his career. He played Duke Mantee in The Petrified Forest. And it's the first time he stopped being a juvenile and played a criminal. And it was a showstopper. He came out unshaven, and he looked like a criminal, and silence seemed to cling to him. He was very successful on the stage. And at that point, he changed from a kind of a juvenile lead, which he had become, into something like a character lead. As you point out, he was never handsome, but he could carry a show.
Stephen Kanfer, and the book we're talking about, his latest, it's titled Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. I look forward to speaking with you. 800-433-8850. And just before the break, Stephen Kanfer, you were talking about Humphrey Bogart's first real success role in the play Petrified Forest, where he played a dime store sociopath. But Humphrey sort of played him very differently. He was playing with Leslie Howard, the star of the play, who promised Bogart the same role in the film version. But why was Edward G. Robinson cast instead?
Because Jack Warner thought that Edward G. Robinson would be far better in the role. He's more famous. He could play tough. And Leslie Howard, who had promised Humphrey that role, was out of town. He was in Scotland fishing. And Robinson would have gotten it, except that Robinson at that point was rebelling. He wanted more money. And Jack Warren didn't like rebels. So he said, all right, go. And by the time Leslie Howard said, look, we need to have Humphrey in this, he was pushing on an open door. Jack Warner just welcomed Humphrey. Not very much money, I must say, but a terrific role. And so Humphrey naturally accepted it.
He got it. And he got to Hollywood, went to work for Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. Was that a good move for him?
Not at first, because they put him in what we were later to refer to as Humphrey Bogart movies. They were movies in which he either got shot and killed in innumerable ways. He got hanged, he got electrocuted, he got shot. He said he spent more time writhing around on the floor than he did standing up in those awful early Jack Warner movies. But later on, he had a break in The Maltese Falcon, and that's what really put him across.
Let's listen to this scene from The Maltese Falcon with actress Mary Astor.
Listen. This won't do any good. You'll never understand me, but I'll try once and then give it up. When a man's partner's killed, he's supposed to do something about it. It doesn't make any difference what you thought of him. He was your partner, and you're supposed to do something about it. And it happens we're in the detective business. Well, when one of your organization gets killed, it's bad business to let the killer get away with it. Bad all around. Bad for every detective everywhere.
You don't expect me to think that these things you're saying are sufficient reason for sending me to this.
Wait till I'm through, then you can talk. I've no earthly reason to think I can trust you, and if I do this and get away with it, you'll have something on me that you can use whenever you want to. Since I've got something on you, I couldn't be sure that you wouldn't put a hole in me someday. All those are on one side. Maybe some of them are unimportant. I won't argue about that. But look at the number of them. What have we got on the other side? All we've got is that maybe you love me and maybe I love you.
You know whether you love me or not.
Maybe I do. Well, I'll have some rotten nights after I've sent you over, but that'll pass. If all I've said doesn't mean anything to you, then forget it and we'll make it just this. I won't, because all of me wants to, regardless of consequences. And because you counted on that with me, the same as you counted on that with all the others.
Would you have done this to me if the Falcon had been real and you'd got your money?
Don't be too sure I'm as crooked as I'm supposed to be. That sort of reputation might be good business, bringing high-priced jobs and making it easier to deal with the enemy. But a lot more money would have been one more item on your side of the scale.
If you'd loved me, you wouldn't have needed any more on that side.
It makes me want to go back and watch every single one of these movies.
Fortunately, not only can you rent them, but they're on all the time. TCM has them on all the time.
I
saw Casablanca last night. It's always possible to catch up with Bogart films. There's some magic in there, particularly this movie, which, as I say, put him across. You know, Louise Brooks was a very good actress who dropped out of films and just sort of became a resident intellectual upstate. And she had acted with Bogart and seen him. And she said that he was uncomfortable with words. And I think she was exactly wrong. He's delivering so much exposition with her and making it work.
Right. But, you know, here's another case where somebody else was supposed to have that role. George Raft.
Yes, George Raft was hot stuff in those days. And he said, when he was given the script, this is not a George Raft picture. He didn't want to be in it. It wasn't big enough. So John Huston, who was directing for the very first time, said, I got Bogey and I was very glad. Because something happened, he realized, when Bogart, and this is something that kids don't understand because they don't watch black and white movies anymore, but black and white changes a person's face. And Bogart was apparently a fairly ordinary person to look at, but when he got in front of the camera, it changed him. He became heroic. And you really gave him great credibility when he was in The Maltese Falcon. He's what Raymond Chandler said, and I took that as my title, Bogart is tough without a gun. He felt that Alan Ladd was a boy's idea of a detective, and Bogart was the real thing. And you see in that little passage, he's talking to Marius, no gun, but he's as tough as can be.
You bet. That was, what, 1941, 1942, just as the U.S. about to get into war. You've got these Falcon movies coming out. But really, success comes late for Bogart.
It does. You can't imagine somebody making it big at the age of 42 in today's Hollywood. It's true that Brad Pitt is 42 today, but he made it when he was 25. It's very, very difficult for anybody to be accepted. I think that would be considered by most of the kids who go, and these are the mall rats. I can call them that because I have granddaughters who are mall rats. These are the people who go to movies pretty much today, and they want to see people, understandably, their own age. So here's this very mature man who's making it. I think that that is a part of the 40s, when you must realize all the world leaders were considerably older. I mean, whether it was General MacArthur or President Roosevelt.
Eisenhower, all the rest.
Sure.
But he's already too old to enlist in the Army, as right. many other actors did. But I gather the studio really wanted to make Bogey patriotic. How'd they do that?
Well, first of all, he was in some war films like Sirocco. But then after the Maltese Falcon, when they realized they couldn't make Maltese Falcon again, they did something called Across the Pacific, using the same actors, Sidney Greenstreet and Mary Astor and so on. And he was against the Japanese at that point. And then came The Blessings of Casablanca, which was not only made at the right time, but Casablanca became a news item because there was a meeting of Churchill and Roosevelt in Casablanca, and that just put that film across and made him a superstar.
All right. I'm going to open the phones to take calls. 800-433-8850. First to Rochester, New York. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi.
I wonder why it is that his performance in the Caine Mutiny is not mentioned that often. I see that as, you know, it was really late in Bogart's career, but I see that really as his true breakout performance in some ways, as far as getting away from this fairly one-dimensional, sort of dogged, single-minded, almost stereotyped character.
It's a great question. It really is a great question, because Bogart did bring to it a kind of sympathy. This is a ship's captain who is breaking down in front of us on the stand, and your sympathies go with him. The one thing I would say is that it was not written for him. It was not written with him even in mind. It was played very differently on the Broadway stage. And when it came time for Bogart to do it, he actually took a cut in pay because he wanted to play that so badly.
Who was it written for?
Well, I don't think that Herman Wouk had any idea when he wrote the book that it was for anybody, but Lloyd Nolan played it on the stage, and he owned that part. And Bogart saw that, and he said, I can do it differently. I can make that part live in a different way. And he did. I mean, it's a very good point that the caller makes. It's true.
So do you agree with the caller that it was one of his real breakout roles?
It is. I show it when I talk about this book at Barnes & Noble. I show a little clip from that. And also because it's a color film. He didn't make that many color films, and it works quite wonderfully.
All right, to Marla in Terre Haute, Indiana. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I am a fan of Humphrey Bogart. I have several of his films, and one of the films that I have in my possession, and I don't know if I'm saying the right, it's called Dark Passage or Dark Journey,
yes.
Something like that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Okay. I was just curious as to why he made that film with Lauren Bacall, because it's such a kind of an obscure film, and it appears to have been done later on maybe in their career.
It was. I think the reason was because they were just such a hot item. After all, you know, she was 19 when they met, and it was a great Hollywood love story, and it was actually a genuine love story because they stayed married. This is his fourth and last wife, and because they tried to cast her in various roles, and they couldn't quite get the right one until he began to sort of produce on his own, and then they did.
Let's hear a scene from To Have and Have Not.
Who was the girl, Steve?
Who was what girl?
The one who left you with such a high opinion of women. She must have been quite a gal. You think I lied to you about this, don't you? Well, it just happens there's $30-odd here. Not enough for boat fare or any other kind of fare. Just enough to be able to say no if I feel like it. And you can have it if you want it.
I'm sorry, Slim. But I still say you're awful good, and I wouldn't take...
Oh, I forgot. You wouldn't take anything from anybody, would you?
That's right.
You know, Steve, you're not very hard to figure. Only at times. Sometimes I know exactly what you're going to say. Most of the time. The other times... The other times, you're just a stinker.
What'd you do that for?
Been wondering whether I'd like it.
What's the decision?
I don't know yet. It's even better when you help. Sure you won't change your mind about this?
Uh-huh.
This belongs to me and so do my lips. I don't see any difference.
Oh, I do.
Okay. You know you don't have to act with me, Steve. You don't have to say anything and you don't have to do anything. Not a thing. Oh, maybe just whistle. You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow.
And of course, that was Humphrey Bogart with the woman who became his fourth wife, Lauren Bacall. And we're talking about Stephen Kanfer's new book. It's titled Tough Without a Gun: The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And what a scene that was. When they first met, as you've already said, she was just 19. Mm-hmm. He was 25 years older right. than she. Not sparks right at the start.
No, as a matter of fact, I think he was somewhat embarrassed to be acting with a 19-year-old who really didn't have a lot of skills, but had that great voice.
But she was a protege of Howard Hawks.
Mm-hmm. And they brought her along thinking she might be a movie actress. She was a model, good-looking model. And Howard Hawks' wife, whose name was also Slim, said she has something of the panther about her. And indeed she did.
The panther.
Yeah, that
I
did
like
come
that.
Across. Yes. Well, she's made an entire life on that line because she is a feline in the way she acts. And with Bogart, there were sparks on screen. And they knew what they had. Hawks knew what he had. And after a while, they did begin to kind of hold hands in the front of a car, like two kids. And he was married at that time and trying very hard in the end, he's married to an alcoholic, to make it work. And it simply couldn't work. And then finally he divorced and married Lauren Bacall, the love of his life.
And if you want to read about Lauren Bacall, there's a piece in Vanity Fair. She is now 86 years old. And just as tough and filled with vitality as ever. Let's go to Steve in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I think Humphrey Bogart's films are just the stuff dreams are made of. And I wanted to ask Mr. Kanfer, do you feel that that knowing the biography of an actor takes away from being able to watch him on screen? And I'll take my answer off the air.
I don't think so. You have to realize an actor is an actor. And he goes to work and he is a character and his life is something else entirely. Often, of course, life informs his art. So I think you should know both, but I don't think you should ever think that because a man plays a dissolute character or a murderer on screen, that's what he's like in private life. You have to see how the life either illuminates the art or the art illuminates the life.
Was he warm? Was he charming? Was he gracious?
My feeling is that he was, for everything that one can find, he was gracious in the sense of being formally gracious. I don't think he opened his life to very many people. He's a very private person. And because he was a sailor, much enjoyed going out on the sea in his boat and getting away from Hollywood and knew how phony much of Hollywood was. After all, this is a man who wore a toupee in most of his pictures, but who wouldn't let them put much makeup on his face. He said, I earned those lines. That's who I want to be. But there was so much tinsel around him, I think he needed to get away from it. And only a few people got past him. Spencer Tracy did, and David Niven among the actors, but he preferred the company of writers.
And what about Lauren Bacall? You called her the love of his life. Theirs was not a placid marriage.
No. In fact, there's some accounts about the fact that he was carrying on with his wardrobe person and makeup person and toupee person. No, it wasn't an ideal marriage, but it was one that worked because I think they worked hard at it. And because she, I think, felt the way he did, that they couldn't go Hollywood and be the person that they wanted to be. So they didn't buy too much into that party scene.
Did you talk with her for this book?
Not for this book. I talked with her long ago because I used to cover theater for Time magazine. And I talked to her about that and talked to her about him. But I think she feels, not incorrectly, that she's who she is and does not want to be tainted only with being the wife of, you know. That's not fair to her.
And, of course, that subsequent marriage to Jason Robards didn't work very well either. All right, we'll take a short break in our conversation with Stephen Kanfer. When we come back, we'll talk about Humphrey Bogart and the House Un-American Activities Committee.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the co-founder of Twitter, Biz Stone. We'll talk about how Twitter was used in Egypt to help organize the revolution and then to spread democracy movements in other countries. We'll also talk about what he had in mind when he co-created Twitter and what surprised him about how it's turned out. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we're back, and our next caller is in Seattle, Washington. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just heard that during those McCarthy hearings that Humphrey Bogart kind of caved in and basically indicted either writers or fellow actors. And I was just wondering if there was any truth to that.
There's quite a bit of truth to it, although it gets distorted as the years go on. Bogart never gave names, never furnished any names, couldn't furnish any names. He never was a member of a communist cell or anything of the kind. But originally he was with a group, Danny Kaye, and the start of the kind of pushback people, Sam Goldwyn and others, who didn't like the fact that this cheap Hollywood committee was coming in and trying to grab headlines. And Bogart was, they met often at his house. He was the prime spokesman, then the Hollywood 10, originally the Unfriendly 19. You know, Billy Wilder said only 10 of them have talent. The other 19 are just unfriendly. But in any case, they lied to their own lawyer, Bartley Crum, and they said they weren't communists when they had been. It would have been better for them to have claimed the First Amendment rather than the Fifth Amendment. And Bogart at that point felt betrayed by them, and he jumped ship. Now, this was not a manly thing to do, and it was not something that he was proud of later on. But he tried to make amends by hiring some blacklisted people and by talking back eventually to the government. But he was quite chastened in 47.
How did that affect his reputation?
I don't think very much. I think that Richard Brooks and other directors felt that he was never the same man, but you can't see it in performance. I mean, that's sort of wish fulfillment, I think.
Here's an email, let's see, from Scott, who says, I remember seeing Truman Capote tell Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show that he once beat Bogey at arm wrestling. And Bogey was completely incensed and had a fit. Is there any truth to this?
All true. Truman Capote was writing almost on a daily basis, Beat the Devil. They sort of made it up as they went along. Well, Casablanca was made up as they went along, too. But this didn't turn out quite so successfully. And in the course of it, here's this little homosexual who was very flaunting in his likes and dislikes and dress. And Bogart began to tease him. And he had been beating everybody, Bogart had, with arm wrestling. And Capote sat down next to him and beat Bogart rather easily. He was a strong little guy. And Bogart did become incensed and tried to wrestle him. And Capote also knew how to wrestle, so he threw him to the ground and caused an elbow fracture. So, and yet, at the same time, after that, Bogart became rather friendly with him. And in the end, wrote to his wife, Lauren Bacall, you should see this guy. I'd like to have him in my pocket and take him out on occasion and watch him.
Here's an email from Alma, who's in Jacksonville, Florida. A group of us were visiting New Orleans a few years ago and wandered into a bar on Bourbon Street where we struck up a conversation with an elderly woman, very well-dressed, who told us she was Verita Thompson, Bogart's mistress. Can you comment?
She wrote a book about it and claimed to the end, it's unsupported, but one sort of tends to believe her because she drops all the right names at the right times, that she was kind of a girlfriend who he let know that he was never going to leave home. He had two children. He was not going to leave Lauren for her, but sort of used her as a sounding board when he was unhappy with the way things were going at home. And to the end, she claimed she was the love of his life. I don't think she was, but she certainly had a good time. She kept saying, oh, honey, did we have fun? I guess they did.
And how was he as a father?
I think he was good as a father, but somewhat remote. I don't think he knew how to handle children. He never really had any experience with it. And the great line, which people claim to be true, is when somebody had a kid who was getting up there, going to be 10, about 10 years old, he said, kind of talk to the kid, you know, about life. So Bogart took him aside and he said, listen, kid, there are 12 commandments. That's the way he began. So I don't think children were a big part.
Of course, the huge movie that he did with Katharine Hepburn, African Queen, was really something else. Here's a small piece of it.
Is something the matter, Mr. Allnut? Tell me.
No. Nothing. Nothing you'd understand.
I simply can't imagine what could be the matter. It's been such a pleasant day. What is it? Yes, Mr. Allnut?
All this foolish talk about the Louisa going down the river.
What do you mean?
I mean, we ain't going to do nothing of the sort.
Of course we are. What an absurd idea.
What an absurd idea. What an absurd idea. Lady, you got 10 absurd ideas for my one.
Just why don't you want to go on, Mr. Allnut?
The river. That's Shona.
Shona?
You're darn right, Shona. All it would take would be one bullet in the blasting gelatin and we'd be the little bits and pieces.
Then we'll go by night.
Oh, no, we won't. After Shona, there's the Rapids, and nobody in their right mind would tackle the Rapids at night.
But then we'll go in the daylight. We'll go on the far side of the river from Shona just as fast as ever we can.
I know we won't.
You agreed to go.
I never did. I never agreed to nothing.
You are a liar, Mr. Allnut. And what is worse, you are a coward.
Ooh! Coward yourself. You ain't no lady, no, miss. That's what my poor old mother would say to you. My poor old mother would hear you. Whose boat is this, anyway? I asked you on board because I was sorry for you on account of you losing your brother at all. What you get for feeling sorry for people. Well, I ain't sorry no more, you crazy psalm-singing, skinny old maid.
Oh, that line. I'll never forget it. How did they get along? How did he and Katharine Hepburn get along?
Famously, they had never worked together. And, of course, there's no romance. I mean, she had Spencer and he had Lauren Bacall, who was there on location in Africa. They got along famously, and I think because they're such opposite types, you know, it's Bogart has a reputation, not incorrectly, of not being able to do comedy, and yet he's so wonderful in this. He is funny.
He's terrific. Opposite her,
because she's such a great catcher. You know, she could let him, he's playing drunk in that, and he's even saying, if you're in your might rind, which is not the way it's written, but he just ad-libbed that, probably made the mistake, and she caught it. And she was always very good with him. And when she had her chance to do her skinny old maid, she did it extremely well. They had to rewrite his part and make him a Canadian. Originally, it's a Brit, but he couldn't do a Cockney accent. So they said, be Humphrey Bogart, do it your way. And he did.
But, you know, you write in the book that everybody else on the set got sick.
Yes, she's a urologist's daughter, so she believed that you have to drink water and water and water. Well, the bottled water was, you know, not really so bottled. And everybody got violently ill. But Humphrey Bogart and John Huston believed in brushing the teeth with beer and drinking whiskey. And they remained healthy through the whole scene.
They remained healthy. One other thing about Humphrey Bogart we haven't talked about. He was not only sort of small in stature, he was short.
Mm-hmm.
How short?
No, he wasn't that short. He was about, I would say, 5'7". Maybe
5'7".
Maybe 5'8". But they used to furnish him with high heels when he was in Westerns. And, you know, he walked the way Julia Roberts walked in Pretty Woman. He was very uncomfortable and looked it. That was not the way he did. But, you know, Alan Ladd was even shorter. There are tricks. There are ways of making him look taller.
Okay. Tall. So did they build those platforms into the shoes?
No, I think what he did was they made him taller by putting him higher than the woman that he was acting opposite. And for the most part, he was with shorter actresses. Anyway.
Lauren Bacall?
No, she's not short, but the others were. No, she was a tall job, and because she was thin, she looked even taller. She's not a giant, but she's
tall.
She's probably 5'9"
or
10.
5'8", 5'9",
right, and when
like
she was
that.
Younger, she was probably even taller.
Probably even taller.
What they did there are very few scenes with the two of them standing.
Yeah.
He's standing or she's standing.
Or the angles which they photograph them, because in that last one, To Have and Have Not, I mean, she's standing over here, he's by the door. It's all very, very
That's what Hollywood magic is about.
Absolutely. Stephen Kantfer and the book we're talking about, Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Now, let's go to Salt Lake City. Erin, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
My question is about his former marriages. I know he reportedly said when his third wife died, his comment was such a waste. And I don't know if you talk about that in the book.
I do.
Okay, could you talk a little bit about that, his marriages?
Well, the marriages were all to other actresses. And originally he was married to a woman who was older than he, and named Helen Menken, and that helped his career to some degree, but it was never going to work. And he married a very pretty woman named Mary Phillips, who was a real careerist and who was not going to go out and watch him be in second-rate stuff in Hollywood when she could be a star, which she was, on Broadway. And so that didn't work. And then he was married to a really sad woman who had some talent but was a violent alcoholic, was physically abusive as well as mentally abusive, and that simply was not going to work either. And
she attacked him with a knife,
stabbed him in the back. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, it was not that deep, but I think that he felt, when he said, what a waste, when he found out about it, he had already been married a couple of years, that she died in Oregon, an obscure motel. She had cancer. It was just a very sad business.
Just had to answer it, Aaron.
Yeah. I really like Humphrey Bogart, but it seemed like a bit of a womanizer, but I guess it lasted with Lauren Bacall until his death.
That's right. I don't think he was as much a womanizer as he was kind of confused. I really think so.
Well, that's one way to put it. Let's go to Nassau in the Bahamas. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. I can't do Bogie's accent doing the African Queen Charlie Allnut scene, but I do enjoy a glass of gin from time to time, and I've had the privilege of having one aboard the original African Queen. And I wondered if Stephen was aware that the boat is currently based at Key Largo, Florida.
It is, and I've often thought I would build a model of it, a small model of it, because I admire that film so much. And I must say, there you are in Nassau. You're enjoying the only good weather in the world right now.
I drink rum here, by the way, but I'm quite happy with gin. But getting back to the African Queen, she was actually built in 1912, you're probably aware, the same year as the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
And she was found in 1952 by a guy called Hosley, who was the production manager for the African Queen. And then she was refitted. By that time, she'd been converted to a diesel engine. In 1952, she had a mock-up for Bogie's filming of the African Queen. And then back in 80, a guy called Langley in England made a replica of the original 1912 engine, and we took the boat over to Ramsgate in England.
There's a book in that, I think.
Yeah, I should say. Thanks for calling, Jim. Tell me about how Bogie found out he had cancer.
He was always, he's one of these people who smoked continually. I sometimes can't bear to watch some of the films because you can see him killing himself with smoke. Although in those days, they all smoked, you know. Everybody in the Army smoked. We all did that when we were in the Army. Smoke, if you got them. And he was coughing so badly that Greer Garson saw him at a restaurant and said, "You've got to see my doctor." And he did. And after a little probing, they realized this was a much more serious thing than just a smoker's cough, and that was the beginning of the end. You know, he said, I haven't been sick a day in my life, and now I feel the rest of my life is going to be spent in intensive care, and so it was. It's a great lesson for anybody who is smoking. Look at this guy who died really at the peak of his career and couldn't go on.
He found out he had cancer. In what year?
Well, he died in 57, so probably 56, I think.
And he weighed 155 pounds then.
Yeah, I mean, and he weighed less. When he was dying, they had a dumbwaiter in the house, and they put him on that because he couldn't make the stairs, and they just take him down.
Wow.
But he was, to the end, he was tough. He refused to give in to it and was never sorry for himself. He continued to receive visitors, and he continued to drink to the end. He just wanted to go out.
To drink, interesting. He weighed something like 80 pounds when he died.
Just skin and bones when he died.
Did Lauren Bacall nurse him?
She did. She was very good about that and accepted a lot of his friends in, even though she knew it was going to shorten the few days that he had, because she felt it was important that he see Spence Tracy for the last time and Katharine Hepburn and all that. And there's a very touching scene where Spencer Tracy says, "Good night, Bogie," and Bogart says, "Goodbye, Spence," because he knew he was going to die the next day and did.
Yeah, and he did.
He did, yes. He knew it.
So... But he's managed to remain.
Yes,
in
he's had an enormous afterlife, both in Bogart festivals and in the style that he represented, which is sort of vanished now. I think, if I may say so, I think women miss that. And I think it's necessary for American life to realize that stoicism has a part. You can't let it all hang out. Some of it has to be kept inside. And I think Bogart was the personification of that kind of existential hero. Camus, after Albert Camus, a Nobel laureate, based his entire outerwear and a lot of his attitudes on what Bogart's affect was on screen. And there, of course, many others.
Explain what you mean when you talk about Camus in that way.
Bogart sort of exhaled a disappointment in the way the world had turned out, but an unwillingness to curse that world. You went through it. As Raymond Chandler said, down these streets a man must go who is neither tarnished nor afraid.
Stephen Kantfer, his new book, Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. What a pleasure to talk with you.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rain.
A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Hearts full of passion, jealousy, and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have his mate that no one can deny. It's